Thank you, Dr. Friedman. It's actually too bad that you ran out of time to go over all of the insights you have. Maybe next year you could talk to the organizers and see if you get a little more time.
That was a slight miscalculation. I didn't know how much I got too involved in the pyramid.
You've talked about the efforts the laboratory has made in improving testing technology that will help us with preventative health care. And you've also pointed out that the physicians in our country have been primarily trained to be therapeutic and diagnostic practitioners. So they're not already trained to be preventative health care physicians. But the technologies that we are developing are, as you pointed out, the most expensive of the technologies. So how do we get to the point where, as an industry, we can recommend protocols to the physicians to say, here's how you appropriately and cost-effectively use our technology to treat people that are already healthy, or that are presumably still healthy. Is there any initiative to create laboratory protocols for the preventative health care portion?
So the question is, how do we pursue preventive medicine? Who's involved in that process? And I'm very pessimistic about engaging our current clinicians in terms of preventive medicine. There are no incentives for that to do that. They're not trained in that area. But yet we have a whole parallel industry of health-oriented individuals. So essentially, I think probably in the long run, we need financial incentives to get physicians involved in preventive medicine. But in the short term, I think what we have to do is the infrastructure exists there with health clubs, with some forms of alternative medicine. And I think consumers are already spending hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, on these kinds of issues. But it's largely outside the sphere of traditional medicine. So I think that the answer is it probably won't be physicians that are engaged in this, because for the most part, they want to spend the least amount of time with the patient, don't want to deal with problems like obesity, high blood pressure, and even diabetes. About a third of patients with type 2 diabetes are put on drugs, whereas alternative measures would suffice to control their blood sugar. So the current apparatus doesn't work for preventive medicine.
Well, I'm equally pessimistic. Would it be appropriate for us as a laboratory industry to be establishing the protocols to give to the clinicians to say, here's how you use the laboratory in a preventative medicine environment?
Well, I would love to see that happen, but I think the only physicians who are less interested in preventive medicine than the clinicians are the pathologists. I just don't see that happening. I think that's an interesting and admirable goal, but I think the system, pathologists and clinicians, are too focused on disease and not on the avoidance of disease. So it's going to take a generation for that to change. But consumers are interested in health. There's probably 500 magazines oriented to health, but for the most part, many of them are not quoting physicians, but they're quoting other healthcare practitioners and not physicians. So I'm pessimistic about bringing classically trained physicians into this process.
One concern is just the dearth of people going into primary care medicine. I mean, in our medical school, it's less than 5%. What people that are interested in internal medicine do now is they become hospitalists. That's what my wife did. And it's because there are really very poor systems to support primary care physicians. They don't have good results management systems. They don't get paid well. They don't, they're not adequately reimbursed. So until we finish, fix those issues, I don't think, creating protocols, really makes sense. We have to, and that's, the total cost of healthcare, why it's double, places that don't, have this focus on rescue care. So I think that's really where emphasis, I imagine, will be placed. I think it's an obvious schism that's occurred over the last few decades, but that has to be fixed first before we can really start talking about preventative care models. I think the consumer-driven side of this will be a big stick to kind of move it into more preventative care. I think consumers want that. So.
I'd like to follow up that question with Anand. That is the thought experiment. We will get to 100% hospitalists. So then the question is, what will the first tier care in the office look like? My own belief, it'll be nurse clinicians driven by algorithms mainly. I just want to make see if he agrees with that.
No, I agree. I think a lot of primary care, and I think the whole concept that you can have this medical home, you can get some lab tests drawn, and it can be not be part of a PCP visit. I think that should be, I mean, there should be very, the traditional model of seeing your PCP, you know, doesn't work when your PCP has no appointments for 3 months. There can be a lot done if we have tight connections with our PCPs that don't necessarily involve the actual MD, the person with the MD title. There's lots of ways to fix this.
I think the current thinking is that the reason that physicians don't go into primary practice is they have such a large debt load, which is now, I think, $140,000. My own belief is that that enters into the equation, but in fact, we're overtraining them to function as an office physician because it's not intellectually stimulating enough. It's more than just income. I think it's not intellectually stimulating enough, so therefore we have to rethink the first tier of healthcare delivery. And I think the retail clinics that we discussed yesterday will be an interesting model. But what's going to, and Anand and I just discussed this, that Mass General is considering going into the so-called retail healthcare business, that is setting up these walk-in clinics. But I think the culture, and we'll turn to Anand, I think the culture of Mass General is that they're not going to understand the culture of a walk-in clinic, and what they will do is make it more and more complicated to emulate the way that they understand medicine, and perhaps it'll probably fail because of business model issues. Anand, I don't know if you want to chime in on that.
Right, I think it's too early to really say, but I on their success or failure. But certainly, the Minute Clinics and those sorts of organizations that have started to pop up in the Northeast are really getting people's attention. And I think Jason's comments about the hospital model, that the hospital, you know, based medicine does everything and has all the outpatient clinics, is clearly going away. People don't want it, and that's really, you know, what drives this is consumers, I think.
I have a quick question. On you, in your presentation, basically said that evidence-based medicine would not work in the lab environment, but yet I hear Bruce saying we need to move towards that structure or an equivalent of it. How do we mitigate those two different opinions?
It's a good point. I mean, evidence-based medicine is why we all went to medical school. I mean, why we, you know, approach medicine as a science. So I think deep down we all feel that, you know, what we do has some level of evidence behind it. When you look for that level of evidence, it's hard to find if you're asking for sort of, you know, class one's levels of evidence. So what we sort of devolve down to is really looking at, you know, shared baselines or clinical guidelines. And I think that becomes the de facto evidence-based medicine. What's the clinical guideline? So for our pediatric genetics group, we're writing, you know, a clinical guideline for how a patient with, you know, autism should be triaged and what tests they should get. I mean, it is evidence-based medicine, but I think it's operating outside sort of the classical, you know, having control groups and the classical evidence-based medicine. But it's actually how sort of industry works to improve process. They write a specification, essentially a clinical guideline, or the equivalent of that, and then they measure themselves and improve around that. I think it's important not to get caught up in, you know, deviations from the guideline are a really bad thing. Deviations from the guideline are an opportunity to learn why the guideline didn't work and an opportunity for discussion. So we try to, we're setting up a sort of a monthly meeting with our pediatric genetics group, so when we see a deviation from the guideline, we can kind of discuss it as a group. You know, why was it necessary to look for Sotos syndrome in this patient? Did they really meet criteria, and are the criteria right? So I think fundamentally in evidence-based medicine, you know, absolutely, but we have to come to something that we can measure today. And outcomes, and especially cost outcomes in medicine, are notoriously hard to measure, even medical outcomes. So what we're left with is variation. But the work of Wenberg, you know, looking at TERPs in New England, or people that have looked at spinal surgery, you know, variation really is the enemy. So if we can measure, you know, adherence to a shared baseline, then we can make progress, I think.
Let me also return very quickly to this question of preventive medicine. There have been was a study in Europe that suggested that 75 or 80% of the problems associated with chronic disease could be avoided through preventive medicine measures. And we're talking about obesity, excessive use of alcohol, lack of exercise, lack of sleep, and good nutrition. If I was king and I would allocate some of these funds not toward classic medicine, that is toward treatment, but toward preventive medicine, and essentially get people into more healthy lifestyles and healthy regimens, and much more money would be saved than perhaps, I shouldn't be saying this, but sophisticated diagnostics and therapeutics where a lot of that money is being wasted.
Just to add a quick comment to Anand's statement about evidence-based medicine. As Bruce, as you mentioned, I'm working with Battelle and the CDC on evidence-based medicine. Some of this is semantics. So what constitutes evidence? And I love the description of clinical guidelines as something in the continuum of evidence, even though it doesn't meet classical definitions of evidence. I think, though, it'd be interesting to hear your comment. I do think that the laboratory profession has not accepted the responsibility for trying to bring a little higher quality of evidence even to their clinical guidelines. I also do not have any problems with deviations, especially if it's purpose. You know, the issue of standardization versus innovation is always difficult, and so purposeful deviations may be still useful in trying to break new ground. But our deviations, our analysis, we frequently pass up opportunities to collect some maybe not rigorous evidence, but better evidence that can help justify what's appropriate. And so what is our responsibility is, I guess, the question, in upgrading what we expect of ourselves, even to move off of clinical guidelines.
Right. I mean, I think there's a lot of responsibility at the provider level, of course. And in truth, why are we so interested in this, at least at a very base level? It's because we've got kind of the sharp end of the stick pointing at us. We, you know, the reference laboratory budget is in our cost center, so we're responsible for the institution for managing, you know, genetic send-out testing. And I think it takes a lot of, you know, a lot of work. You have to meet with the leadership of these departments and really get them invested in something they're not directly accountable for. And so the incentives really aren't there in most areas of healthcare to get that. So you have to really, you know, take it at a very high level, meet with the leadership of the departments first, and get people to really buy into this idea that we have this shared responsibility about developing guidelines for this incredibly expensive testing. It becomes an easier conversation now where hospital, you know, reimbursements are about to sort of drop in the tank than it was maybe, you know, just a few years ago when the hospitals were doing a lot better. But I think we've had very, you know, good response when we go to the leadership of these departments and tell them we want your help in developing clinical guidelines. So
one last anecdote. I had a telephone conversation with some experts from the CDC that were talking about introducing rules into EMR test ordering protocols. So if the physician orders the wrong test, it says no, 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 go back and we'll start the whole routine all over again. And I'm saying, first of all, most EMRs don't have the cycles to have those kind of iterative conversations with the physicians. I said, secondly, the clinicians are trying to get through their day. And basically, right now, they feel burdened by spending 45 minutes in front of the terminal because what we've done is transfer work that used to be done by ward secretaries to the clinicians. And there's evidence that 90% of alerts, drug incompatibilities that come through the EMR are ignored by the physicians. So we've gotten them so inured to all these warnings that essentially they don't pay any attention to them anymore. So essentially we have to start with the clinicians, and you can't do this via computer-based rules because they just ignore them. They have to get through their day, and their workload is increasing. So something's going to break with these systems, and I think we're approaching it in the wrong way.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to call to the podium Rob Bush, Kelly Feist, Dirk Sengson, and John Yount, and I'm going to get my notes, and I'll come right back. Okay, this is the build as the executive officer panel discussion. This is always my favorite part of the conference and always has been because it's spontaneous and open. We have executives from four major companies, and I'm going to start with John and have each of them in turn introduce themselves so you know who they are and their affiliation. Following that, I'm going to ask each of the individuals to give a sort of 2 or 3 minute presentation about what they think is going to happen to the LIS and if they want to merge into this, the EMR industry on a 3-year horizon, what major changes they see happening to sort of set the stage. This is going to be a forward-looking, future-looking, future-oriented conversation to let all of you acquire some information and knowledge about what's going to happen in our industry. Following those little intros and those perspectives on the future of lab computing, I will now solicit from the audience any questions that you have following up on any of those points. I've distributed a list of 11 questions to the panel members. So if there are no questions from the audience, we can revert to my list. The last 2 years, we've had sufficient questions from the audience that we didn't have to go to my questions, and I prefer to solicit questions from you. So we'll start with John. We'll do the introductions. After the introductions, we'll cycle back to John. He'll give his 2 or 3 minute dialogue about the future of lab computing, and then we'll open the open for questions from the audience. So John, tell us who you are.
Hi, John Yount with McKesson. I'm responsible for product management, product marketing, and our development organizations for the organization. Probably the best way I could describe my role outside of just development and product management is that I'm very fortunate to work within our life sciences organization in that we're investing quite significantly in the area because we understand that the lab solution is going to be pretty much the foundation for what we're going to be able to achieve in delivering personalized medicine.
Feist, I'm with Sunquest Information Systems. I am responsible for marketing and product management for Sunquest. And at Sunquest, we do see that a move toward a diagnostic platform is extremely important to support not only what we do today, but also to support where we go in the future with the advent and the promise of predictive and personalized medicine.
My name is Dirk Sengson. I'm the founder and CEO of Aperio. So we're not an LIS vendor, but the fact that we're up here talking about digital pathology, hopefully, tells you something about the emerging importance of digital pathology and imaging modality in the lab industry.
My name is Rob Bush. I'm president of Orchard Software. So I think that means my responsibility is that I try to have my organization run as smoothly as possible, meeting needs of our clients, and then I'm disruptive to that process.
So John, let's cycle back to you and just make some terse statements about what you think is going to happen on the LIS horizon. You started to talk about the criticality of the lab platform. That's obviously music to our ears, but make some statements about what's going to happen if you can.
Certainly. So roughly about 3 years ago, McKesson ventured down the path of having to create a life sciences organization in recognition of the growth within molecular diagnostics and identifying how we were going to best prepare and support the advent of personalized medicine, predictive care, and get into the wellness side of the business. At the time that we did that, we consolidated the organization that owned our physician order entry tools as well as our laboratory information solutions in preparation for building a tool set that was going to be much more integrated than what HL7 offers us today, because we have so many markers that are being generated by the number of molecular tests that are being created. There's so many unknowns about exactly what that's going to entail and how large it's going to be, that we knew that we needed to have a flexible data model and also an integrated solution that we were going to be able to provide real-time, actionable, evidence-based content to the physician community so that they would be able to address a person's care directly at the time of order. So we continue to work down that path. We see that for us, we believe that the evolution of molecular diagnostics will significantly impact the anatomic pathology solutions, and that is where we have spent a significant amount of our effort and developments to address the workflows needed by the pathologist and also to start to address a lot of what Dr. Friedman has been driving for the last few years is the diagnostic medicine, not just from a testing perspective, but also from an imaging solution as well.
I'd like to poll the audience. In the audience, how many of you are satisfied with the support for molecular diagnostics that is provided by your current LIS?
We're doing well.
One.
So I see that as an opportunity. and particularly having heard Dr. Vasilovic's talk, there's not a system in the world that can accommodate the kind of reporting and the one's biome in terms of reporting function. So I think our work is cut out for him. And John, you highlighted that deficiency, I think, in current systems. Kelly?
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So I think Dr. Friedman has a great point. We see an opportunity for improvement in molecular diagnostics as well. So I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But one of the things that I do want to point out is when I look at how laboratories function today and how they're viewed by the rest of the enterprise in which they operate today, they are basically viewed as a department. And, you know, in my way of thinking, a department is generally associated with a cost center. And I think if we're going to be successful moving forward collectively, you know, we're going to have to, as a vendor, provide tools that will allow the laboratory to be seen as a service line, which, in my experience, is typically looked at by the rest of the enterprise as something associated with revenue generation, right? So what we're doing at SunQuest is we're really looking at how do we provide tools that elevate the lab out of a departmental status and into the status of a service line. And among those things is obviously molecular diagnostics. You know, we understand that what was an esoteric test 5 years ago is a mainstream test today, and the esoteric tests of tomorrow aren't being done yet. So that's one point that's very important to our thinking currently. Another point that Dr. Friedman also made is that there is convergence coming down the pike between clinical pathology and anatomic pathology, and we need to understand that convergence and make sure that we're providing tools that support that. And among that, you know, one of the thoughts within the convergence is that we understand digital pathology is also something that must be supported. Along the lines of providing tools that make the lab a service line within the facility really is the idea that, you know, to be a service line, you've got to measure your success. There have to be some metrics associated with what you're providing to the rest of the facility. And, you know, business intelligence and analytic tools are something that, you know, is pretty much missing in our industry today. So we need to make sure that we're providing ways to measure and present and raise the visibility of the lab within the facility. And finally, reporting. You know, the ability to aggregate data, the ability to present complex data in a way that is actionable and information-based, you know, evidence-based, if you will, is definitely important. And, you know, part of my background is in the cardiology space, and the one thing that I learned there is for a cardiologist, his product is his report. And the same is true for a pathologist. Your product is your report. That's how you generate more referrals to your service line, if you will. So I think that it's extremely important that we understand what is needed in reporting, how that data should be aggregated, how it should be presented in a way that makes it actionable.
I don't want to put Dirk on the spot, but when he said, I'm not an LIS vendor, what was going through my mind was, oh, yes, you are. We may not define it that way, but I would say very quickly, you become a key LIS vendor. But with that, Dirk.
Yeah, so, you know, we give a lot of thought to what the future holds, because, of course, we're charting a new course. And I think as a leader in the space, we can actually influence where we go. So we kind of look at major trends. So I think Bruce talked about the convergence of pathology and radiology into sort of an integrated diagnostic department. You look at the convergence of the clinical pathology and the anatomic pathology departments. I think those hold challenges for certainly information management systems. I think there's also, as we've seen in radiology, you know, the RIS system, the radiology information system, and the PACS have seen a convergence. I think in our space, there is no PACS, but I think digital pathology is going to step into the role of being the pathology PACS. And I think over time, you're going to see a convergence of the current LIS systems with you know, the emerging digital pathology or PACS system. So I think those systems are going to have to integrate more closely. So I think if you look at those trends, there's some interesting challenges for how information will be managed. We also have a perspective about how pathologists will interact with, let's say, imaging information in the future. I think in two ways. There will be a pathologist cockpit, in the same way that radiologists have an information management cockpit that gives them all the information they need at their fingertips. There will be such a pathologist cockpit, whether it combines the gross images, the microscopic information in digital slide format, whether it's molecular information, whether it's a case history, proteomics information, what have you. So I think fundamentally, as you think about how the industry is changing, the pathologists are going to want to put their eyes on this type of information. I think it remains to be seen whether that's provided by the pathology PACS or digital pathology community, or whether the LIS vendors can actually integrate enough to provide the interfaces for that. I think that's interesting and challenging. I also see the same analogy that, you know, if you look at the clinical path lab, you have clinical chemistry analyzers. You will have digital pathology analyzers in the future. You might say, well, what on earth would you do with a digital pathology analyzer? And the reality is that you will be able to automate a lot of the various tedious tests that pathologists do today, looking for events, scoring slides, screening for abnormalities. That can all be done on a digital pathology analyzer. You can run all those tests. And then as a result, the pathologist will have much more time wearing his or her MD hat and much less time wearing their technician hat where they're just doing, you know, a work that a computer could do. So by transforming the whole field to go digital, we can actually create a whole new industry of instrumentation, of tests that can be built for in exciting new ways, and empower the pathologist to provide more value to his customer, the oncologist or the surgeon.
Dirk, I have to ask you a tough question, and I know you've thought about this, but looking at the medical imaging industry as a whole, we have 100% adoption on the radiology side. And I know I've read a lot in the literature that the current radiology PACS system will evolve into the enterprise image server. With that kind of overwhelming clout, how do we get breathing space on the lab pathology digital side? We get overwhelmed by this juggernaut.
So I think the adoption in the lab or the pathology industry will happen initially as a department-wide offering. So I think if you look at how radiology evolved, it started with the department and then it went to the enterprise. And I think the value in the radiology department or the cardiology department had to be demonstrated separately, and then there was value in the enterprise. That's how certainly we're seeing adoption in pathology. 0% of our customers are looking at this as an enterprise opportunity. They're saying, you know, there's a pathology department, and you have a workflow solution for the pathology department, and you store your digital slide images in servers that are pretty much managed separate from the PACS system. I think in the future, you'll want to store digital slide images in the existing enterprise storage environment. And there have been efforts ongoing to establish DICOM standards for digital slide images. So I think you'll see those accepted and adopted in the next year. We'll have a standard for digital slide images for DICOM, and then it'll take a number of years for the existing enterprise imaging vendors, you know, the big ones, GE, Siemens, McKesson, and so forth, to support those standards. And then I think you'll have the opportunity to store digital slide images in a PACS. But I think the pathologists are going to want to start with this as a department-wide solution. I don't think they're looking for their CIO to cram something down their throat. It's too new. So I think for the next 3, 4, 5 years, this is a department-wide offering, and then it'll emerge slowly to the enterprise.
Rob Bush.
Well, I'd like to identify, when we look at the future, what do we think is going to happen to us, identify two trends. One kind of dovetails into the other. And maybe they're pretty obvious things. But the first is that I think all of us are, it's a little bit like standing under a dam when they open the dam, and we're in a valley and the water's rushing at us. This initiative to put EMRs in the hands of every doctor is going to be a large influence on us as a laboratory, because every one of them wants laboratory results in that EMR. And they want to do it in a fairly short period of time. And what we're all going to face is that if we aren't doing a good job of putting our results inside that less than adequate display of laboratory results tool that the doctors buy, we'll lose the customers. And if you're faced with losing half your customers because you haven't got any good interfacing tools to their EMR, that's a big influence on you. So I think that over the next 3 years, we're going to focus a lot of attention on that. And it means that we probably won't focus as much attention on what do we do inside the lab to improve our efficiencies. Not that we should stop that, but it'll take away from the efforts to do a better job with our molecular reporting. Because, you know, the 800-pound gorilla is this water coming down the valley. That's the EMRs where we have to cope. And I think in order to make that happen, we're going to have to change our interfacing models. Right now, we primarily do point-to-point interfaces, and that's an expensive and time-consuming task, and we're already getting behind. So the initiatives to have a better model of how we can inexpensively and accurately put interfaces in place, which start with things like the project that we've got going here, showing you interoperability between systems, which is a different model than the model we've been using in the past, we're going to have to put those in place. We're going to have to do them rapidly. It means we'll all have to write different interfaces in order to make that happen. But I think coming out of that, we'll find that the adoption of that technology will allow us to start doing things inside, when we have time to start refocusing, inside the laboratory environment that'll make us better. I like Dirk's description of a pathology cockpit. And I think that the tool for the pathologist is different than the tool to the clinical lab manager, and it's different than the tool for the physician. All of them are looking at similar information, but do it in different ways. And the notion that the diagnostics departments are merging doesn't necessarily mean that we have to have one software package that meets the needs of all those people. It means we have to make sure that the same information is available to all of those people. And in these better interfacing tools, we have the opportunity that you could take the pathology cockpit and it could say, I now have a specimen and I think I've identified a cancer. And I'd like to know more information in order to do a better job taking the next step. So let me go out to the EMR and say, doctor, you ordered a test from me, so you should be willing to give me more information. I'd like to know the diagnostics history of this patient. I'd like to know the surgical history. Can you tell me the medications that this patient is currently on? And that kind of information can come to my pathology cockpit so that I can make a better decision. And the ability to have that information come to me is the result of this more sophisticated interfacing technology that we put into all our systems, which is going to be driven by the interfaces to the EMR to be able to do it effectively. So we'll use that kind of sophisticated interfacing technology to then turn it on ourselves and do a better job of allowing us. So it means that as a department, we may consolidate the clinical lab, anatomic pathology, radiology departments because the people start working together. But it doesn't mean you have to have the same software package. Each of us could start picking our own cockpit package and then pull data from other sources. So.
Okay, why don't we open now for questions? Bob McGonigal has a traveling mic. Please direct your question to an individual or to the group, and we'll do the best we can. Any questions?
Hi, this is directed, I guess, first to Mr. Young, because his product is what we have. In Indiana, we've got about nine-order hospital system. Good news, bad news is the physicians, as far as the EMR, they love Horizon Physician Portal. Bad news is, now they keep on asking us questions that, well, why can't I do X, Y, and Z? And we're trying to explain them. No, it's just a viewer. You know, it's a reader like Adobe. And, you know, vis-a-vis the discussion this morning about physician order entry, how do you see you folks helping us, helping the physician interact with the laboratory world? As Dr. Friedman said, you know, the physician's sitting there doing the order entry that used to be done by ward clerks, and they're spending 45 minutes doing this, and they don't like that.
Yeah. So one of the things that we're working on to improve that process is that as part of our physician order entry tool, which is accessible through the portal, we will be providing lab data directly to that through direct integration into the database to make that available for the ability to do evidence-based decisions. That is the key reason why we consolidated, formed a life sciences organization, moved our physician order entry organization underneath that from a development perspective, and then also brought the laboratory both from the LIS and the AP solutions into the same model. So we're about a year into that. We're working through what we believe the data model needs to be within the LIS to better support what we term as I-forms within our solution to be able to produce something that's actionable for the physician through the portal directly.
To a certain extent, I think one of the problems is the LIS is being disintermediated with the EMR, and essentially my own view is this federated architecture would give more power to the LIS rather than essentially taking all data that we format and have learned to do this for 50 years, essentially deconstructing it and sending it in this HL7 stream to the EMR. I believe in this federated model, and that's one of the reasons we've been pushing this, but basically, the LIS was much less important from the perspective of the clinicians than it was 20 or 30 years ago.
I have one follow-up.
Yeah.
Are you using our CPOE solution today, or are you just using the portal for viewing? That would be the next step that we would need to work with you is to integrate that piece into the portal and roll that out across your organization. Which I think, as we all know, and as many of us have read, delivering CPOE to the organization isn't without some challenges and some effort, but that would be the next step that we would need to take.
Another question?
Yeah, this is a question for anyone or everyone on the panel. As you're probably aware, the economy's pretty tough these days, and I'm wondering what sort of rationale or services your company provides to prospective clients who almost invariably are replacing an existing system. What sort of services and what sort of rationale can you provide them to help justify that expenditure in replacing a system?
Great question. Anyone on the panel? Kelly?
I can answer that. So just to paraphrase the question, in the tight economy, what can we as vendors do to help ensure that our customers understand what their potential return on investment could be, and how could we help them essentially acquire the technology they need to meet their goals? So when I look at the tight economy, I think there are two things that tend to continue to get capital funding. Anything that can reduce cost and anything that is patient safety associated, right? So what I believe is if we can provide technology that helps to support not just patient safety initiatives in the lab, but enterprise-wide patient safety initiatives. There's a definite and measurable ROI that goes along with that. So we're focusing not just on how do you improve processes in the lab, but what kind of tools can we provide to the nursing staff, to the emergency department staff, that will help prevent errors in specimen labeling or collection or administration of transfusions, for examples. These are specific patient safety initiatives that are enterprise-wide that the lab can take leadership on and should take leadership on. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, how do you reduce costs? You know, if we can have measurable ROI, going back to the patient safety discussion again, there are significant costs that can be reduced with good patient safety initiatives. When you look at how reimbursement is occurring, or should we say not occurring, for preventable medical errors, that is a direct savings to the bottom line. You know, when you're talking about hospitals that typically operate on a margin of less than 5%, and reimbursement is no longer happening for preventable medical errors, care that's the result of preventable medical errors, that margin goes down even further. So those are some of the things that, as vendors, I think we can, you know, definitely support immediately for both cost savings and patient safety. I think the other thing, too, is, you know, understanding that, you know, most software operates on a perpetual software fee license is, you know, the standard way of doing business. I think that we can, you know, also be a little bit creative in helping deliver alternative acquisition models. You know, is it possible to provide subscription-based pricing, for example, so that the purchase comes out of an operational budget instead of a capital budget? I think those are also things that we can take leadership on.
In terms of pricing, Kelly, I have a follow-up question. Maybe others people would like to chime in. Does anyone see any movement toward lab storage or lab applications in the cloud as opposed to a current hardware apparatus that or server that you own and control, and perhaps capturing some cost reductions by cloud-type computing as opposed to your own computer room? And what appeals to me from that perspective is it perhaps gives us an opportunity to get out from under the control of the mainframe group and essentially control our own servers and applications in the cloud.
So Aperio actually recently introduced a slide sharing service which eliminates a lot of the IT costs that are incurred by our customers. So, you know, when we typically talk about integrating a digital pathology system, there's a lot of effort by the IT department to get comfortable with managing large images on their networks. And so that takes a lot of time, effort, and delays. So, you know, we've moved that into the cloud, so to speak, so that people can actually move these digital slide images to a data center and then access them. And there's actually no port that's required to be opening your firewall. So that simplifies the solution, lowers the barriers to adoption, and actually lowers cost as well.
Dirk, are you getting any pushback in terms of, quote, HIPAA pushback in terms of the cloud for storing?
It needs to be HIPAA compliant. So the requirement for us is that whatever is in the cloud needs to be HIPAA compliant, needs to be audible. So
my question is, does that satisfy the hospital executives and the pathologists, or do they raise another level of concern beyond that?
No, in our discussions, if it's HIPAA compliant, it's something that they can audit, they're satisfied.
I'd add there, too, as far as remote hosting or ASP models, we certainly recognize the need for it. We actually will be taking our first lab customer live on a remote hosting model in roughly the next 60 to 90 days. So we've recognized that need. We've started to move that direction and offer that as a solution. I will say in a visit that I had just recently with a customer, and this is something that I do hear that's common, is that while there is a voice to move out from under the management of hardware in the data center, there still is a concern with the subscription and transaction or ASP models, in that specifically if you're interested in the outreach business and you're trying to grow that you don't have a fixed cost any longer for the growth of that business. You're continuing to add not only to the revenue side of the business, but you're adding to the cost side of the business with the ASP or transcription model. So, price per transaction model. So it's a balance. I think, truthfully, the industry's got to be able to support both models going forward. I don't think that we're going to see the industry evolve to take one firm direction either way. I think there's just too many different organizations and different approaches, and as LIS vendors, we have to be able to support them all.
Let me point out very quickly some ambiguity about the definition of the term cloud, and we've heard it. Dirk talked about the cloud as a pure vehicle for storage, and that becomes critical in terms of digital pathology because those storage requirements are great. John talked about went beyond the cloud as a storage vehicle, but cited SaaS software as a service. That is, you have information processing in the cloud in addition to storage. And when Yule talks about the cloud, oftentimes, at least from the perspective of Litz Interop, it's only an opportunity or platform for making connections without any data storage in the cloud. So there are three different definitions of cloud. So just understand that that's about as some can be as ambiguous as other terms that we use, or such as middleware. But anyone else want to react? Rob, you want to react to anything?
Just a couple comments. Back to Dennis's question about do we see a difficulty in today's economy with cost justifying things? I think there are more. There are lots of issues that help people justify continued expenditures. We see a lot of labs that come to us and say, I can't find enough technologists to grow the business the way I need to grow it, so I need to find ways to streamline. So they're investing in technology instead of investing in more people. And I think that that certainly justifies some of the investment. As to the question, and of course, for those of you who saw Jason's presentation yesterday about disruptive technology, I'm not sure I like the term rebar manufacturer, but that's the segment of the market that we started in. And so we're relatively low-cost solution. I just wish as we move up the market that the other LIS vendors would discontinue their participation in those markets the way the steel industry did. They're not just laying over and dying. I haven't figured that one out.
I'm sorry, Brent.
But with regard to remote hosting or... we have about 850 laboratories that are running our system. We have a couple different products, but we have a web-based product, and it certainly can be hosted by us. We only have two clients that have asked us to host a system. We offer it both ways, but both of those two asked us to do it for political reasons. They fought over where it should go, and the solution was, neither of us will take it. We'll leave it somewhere else. So the overriding concern was they wanted to have the data inside their own firewall, and they wanted to be able to touch it, and it didn't really matter what it cost. They didn't want to use it. They didn't want to host it outside their system.
The other point I was going to make is that in this economy, clearly the emphasis can and should be on cutting costs, but there's also revenue opportunities that come with these technologies. So when we talk to customers, we try to identify additional sources of revenue. So there's a reimbursement in place for certain image analysis capabilities that digital pathology can provide. If you're sending out samples to somebody for a secondary consultation, you're sending out the whole block. If you can share the slide digitally, you can now retain the technical component of that work in your own laboratory, and you can improve the revenue that you generate. So there's definitely revenue opportunities buried in this as well. So no doubt everybody's focusing on reducing costs or increasing revenue, but I did want to say it's not all about reducing costs. There are definitely ways in which revenue can be increased as well.
Recall, continuing very briefly with Dennis's point about the cost of software, recall that middleware is defined frequently as functionality not provided by my LIS vendor. And in fact, most middleware is fairly reasonably priced. So people who are looking for additional functionality that can't get it from their LIS vendor, or it's either not available or perhaps too pricey, what they do is install middleware to fulfill that functionality need. Now, the downside of that is they've got another functionality and another server running that middleware and a greater, more complex enterprise to run. But that's another reaction in terms of cost, return on investment for software. Other questions?
Hi, my question is to Rob Bush. Rob, you
alluded a lot to better technologies for interfacing, and yet to
I'm
to,
sorry, I can't. I can't
you
hear
alluded
you.
A lot to much better technologies today for interfacing all the different software packages, and yet to quote from Dr. Diga's presentation, he said that interoperability today is still really just a fantasy. So can you say what you mean by much better technologies for interfacing, and do you see us all going towards at least a standard way of doing that?
Yes. Could everybody hear the question?
Why don't you just repeat it?
Okay. Well, she's asked me to. I'll try to paraphrase it as well as she said it, but to be more specific about the better technology for interfacing, given that some other people are saying that, you know, it isn't there. It isn't there today. And I agree that it isn't there today. I think that we have technologies that we could choose to use, but there's this tipping point or critical mass issue. Who wants to be the first one? And just as an example of that, let me point to something we all deal with, which is instrument interfaces are still using serial port connections with RS-232 cables, which is pretty old technology. It's, you know, it's almost hard to find a computer that has an RS-232 port on it. So we have to, and the instrument manufacturers made an effort to start letting you use a TCP/IP interface at one point, but it created some havoc for them. They would plug into the network of the laboratory, and the workstation that ran the instrument got a virus or something. So they'd detach it from the network and say, let's go back to a serial port. That's a lot safer for us. So it's been difficult to change technologies there, and our point-to-point interfacing is in the same kind of boat. An example of a better technology is web services. A few people have tried to move in that direction, but unless everybody does, it's a difficult thing to fund if you're not going to be able to use it. But you know, for those of you who aren't as familiar with the technologies, imagine a web page. All of us could log on to the same web page and log on and get information from that web page, and they don't have to have an interface to each one of us. It's just they're capturing information and delivering information back to us. If our laboratories and our medical record systems used a web services interface, instead of being point-to-point, they could open up their site, and if you have an account and you're communicating in a more narrowly defined way, then it's possible to proliferate those interfaces much more quickly than it is with a point-to-point interface where you're navigating all of that. But there are some things that have to go in place that the government can do for us that will help. One example, I don't remember how long it's been since the very first phase of HIPAA was put into place, 4 or 5 years ago. And when phase one was introduced, they said to us, we're just going to start using common terminology. So we've got 5 different tables, and I want to have everybody agree we're going to use the same terminology. We're all going to use CPT codes. We're all going to use diagnosis codes. We're all going to identify doctors with a specific code. One of the tables was, we're going to have a table that identifies every insurance plan so we can use a code instead of having to send a massive amount of information about an insurance program. But the procedure codes are maintained by the AMA. The diagnosis codes are a separate society that maintain those. That list of insurance companies was supposed to be maintained by the government, by CMS. Well, it's the only one of those tables that we're required to use by HIPAA that we don't have. I called CMS and said, where is that list? And they said, well, we don't have it yet. And I said, well, does that mean you're breaking the law? Didn't you pass a law that we all have to use this table and you won't give us a table? And I irritated somebody, but, you know, I had to get it off my chest. But I think that in order for us to be able to move forward with that kind of integration, right now it's expensive for us to map an insurance table every time two people want to interface. I call this Blue Cross Blue Shield, and you call it BCBS. And somebody has to manage the mapping of all that. Well, if we want the table mapping to go away, we have to have some standards for the tables. So I think we're going to have the government step in and say, okay, I'm going to make some decisions, and we're all going to do this format of We're going to use these tables. We'll do a better job making sure we get the tables there. We're all going to use this technology, web services, for example, which is a stable technology. And by doing that, then all of us will be able to invest in that better technology in order for it to go in place. And I think that web services technology is what will let us start sharing information among lab systems. The other thing that they're going to have to insist upon is that the interfacing we're doing right now is generally transaction-based. The lab expects an order to come in from an EMR or someplace, and we expect to send a result. But we're going to have to start being able to do something more elaborate than that. We have to, if someone says, can you send me all the results for Rob Bush, not just the order I made, but everything that's relevant to something, like my pathology system that wants to know a history of results. And if they have the authority to be able to get that information, I need to be able to pass a larger amount of information. So we'll have to define some standards on how we're going to do that. But if we do, there's a radically different value in what we can do with the interfaces. We can make it faster. And I don't think the technology is out of our reach, but we have to have agreement and guidance to make that happen.
This interface question is a very interesting one. I'd like to pull the rest of the panel members. Let me start with Dirk, and then I'll go to Kelly and then to you, John. Just quick about your policy on interfaces, how that could be improved, or your degree of satisfaction with how that's going.
So, you know, we came to this party a little bit late after all the LIS vendors had their systems in place. And it took a lot of effort to get anybody to interface to us. So, you know, the market's now evolved where I think you're seeing more interfaces being announced. But, you know, I don't want to rain on anybody's parade, but the LIS industry is not an open industry. Nobody's publishing standards. It's not easy to get interfaces. You have to develop personal relationships and convince people there's a market and so forth. So I think, in general, this is not an industry where people are actually saying, let's just interface, let's develop standards. I think there's, if you think about it from somebody who has the monopoly on the business, why would they want to interface and allow somebody else to kind of get into the game? So I think this is maybe part of the issue. So I think without interfaces, the market won't move forward. And I think we're going to see more and more of that, and I think it's actually in the industry's self-interest to support those interfaces. But, you know, if you're the executive at a big company, you own the whole space, why would you want to open it up? So I think there's some soul searching that has to be done about where the business is going. Look, and I'm saying this as an outsider, sort of now in the business. But, you know, we have, and then I'll be self-serving here, but I mean, Perio publishes all of its interfaces on its website. You can go to our website, and we publish the APIs for all of our software products so others can interface to them. We give away our viewing software for free. And I think if you look back and you sort of say, well, has that helped the market? The answer is, yeah, we've made the pie a lot bigger. So I think being open and sharing data makes the market bigger. And it's sort of a unique way of looking at it. But our sense is that this is probably what's going to be required in this industry as well. But without interfaces, none of the things that we're trying to accomplish in terms of solving healthcare problems and information management are going to be done.
I would also like to give credit to Aperio for being, as far as I know, one of the only or the only corporate blogger in existence. In addition to that, and Dirk, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but they've taken their user group, and that has evolved into a digital pathology open conference that goes beyond just a user group. So Aperio has been very generous in terms of taking what used to be proprietary approaches and opening that up in an educational way. So I thank Aperio for that. Kelly?
Thank you. So in regard to the question, you used the term interoperability and mentioned in a previous discussion, interoperability was really described as a fantasy. And I think we have to understand that there's a difference between interfacing and true interoperability. So, you know, we've heard the term interface, and then the term kind of evolved to integration as the next step between, you know, from a straight point-to-point interface to something that's a little bit more valuable than that. And now we use the term interoperability. I think we have a ways to go before we are, as an industry, really interoperable. But from my point of view, you know, as part of what is a best of suite vendor, without interfacing, being as interoperable as possible, you know, we would not be relevant, right? So we believe that we do need to make those connections, and we have actively made those connections, you know, with other vendors, and it doesn't matter if it's an EMR vendor, if it is, you know, a digital pathology vendor. You know, those are companies that we do need to make sure that we can work with, that we can interface to, integrate with, et cetera. You know, there was some discussion about, is it an HL7? Somebody said earlier today, you've seen one HL7 interface, you've seen one HL7 interface. It was Yule. And I think that that's true. So as the standard for interfacing being HL7, we know that that's not a perfect standard, and that there is plenty of variability within that. Do we need something else? I think we probably do, but I do agree with Rob Bush in that there needs to be some agreement in the industry as to what that standard should be, so that it becomes an industry standard and not just, you know, well, this is what a specific company or vendor chooses to do, and then other companies or vendors choose to do other things. So I think we do need, you know, what is the next standard? We've got HL7. Is there a better way to do it? You know, let's identify that and determine what that standard should be.
So I guess being from McKesson, we're taking a slightly different view on it. We absolutely know that interfaces aren't going anywhere. We have to play in that market. We have to be a part of that. We have to communicate with other systems. I think one of the things that we've looked at in a recent example is the work that we have done with Aperio to be able to launch whole slide images directly within our anatomic pathology solution for the workflow and support the pathologist. But I really think we're trying to approach it a little differently in that we're looking at the core systems that are driving a lot of the decision making for the physician, and saying those systems need to be on the same architecture and the same database and sharing and communicating amongst one another. And so when I look at what we're doing, taking our LIS, putting it on the same architecture, we already have our med administration tools on the same architecture. We have our CPOE solutions on the same architecture. We believe that that is going to be extremely important to the success of these solutions going forward, and that those core solutions are able to share that data without going through interface technology. Another example of that would be our anatomic pathology solution. So two-sided, we've had to focus on integrating to a third-party solution, and that would be Aperio. But we also have just recently integrated our own PACS solution as well as other DICOM compliant to where we can launch PACS images now directly within our AP solution as well. So again, we've looked at it from two fronts. Can we put things on the same architecture, leverage the fact that they're in the same database structures, but also recognize that we have to be open and work with the outside communities to deliver the best patient care.
I think we have time for one last question, Bob. Anyone want to finish up?
If no one else has one, I'll ask one to end with. Thinking again of Jason Wang and this whole idea of disruptive innovation, all of you know, and it's been documented, I think, best by Hal Weiner, how many hundreds of laboratories there are in the United States that have legacy systems that are really very, very old, that it's very difficult now to add any functionality to the system. I suppose it's good for middleware people, et cetera. But I was wondering, for those laboratories, where would they look for the equivalent of the Sony transistor radio that we all got as kids in the 50s and 60s, if you had to advise them where to look?
You must have asked a tough question there. We're all
in other words, a very simple, easy solution.
So they want to upgrade or update their system, but want to do it very inexpensively?
I think the way this is going to go into the cloud, that's where the innovation is going to come from, because if you have all that data stored and you've got, you know, a legacy system, you know, where are you going to put it in the most open, interfaceable way? You're going to put it out in the cloud. So I think there's an opportunity for LIS systems in the cloud, and I think if you think about most things we're doing, they're probably going to be out there in the cloud. I mean, Bill Gates has been trying to get us to you know, use Word and Office and other products in the cloud, so to speak, meaning accessible through the internet. And I think that's the future. I mean, you do banking already that way. Why wouldn't your LIS be in the cloud? And if it was that way, it should be, you know, the obstacles are lower. You don't have to pay for all the IT infrastructure in an institution. It's easier to switch. So I think there's lots of benefits, and I think if you have a legacy system, that's certainly the transistor radio.
Who's going to lead the way? Is it going to be a new entrant, or is it going to be an established incumbent that'll pursue that technology?
I think that for every an individual lab, evolutionary change is easier than revolutionary change. It's always easier for them to put a Band-Aid on it than it is to throw it out and put another one in, although I'd love for them to come and talk to me. But we've seen in the industry a migration toward these tools, and Band-Aid's probably the wrong term, but I think today a laboratory manager is becoming an IT professional. All of the major instrument vendors have major initiatives with middleware products, and I think that makes sense. They do a better job taking the information coming out of their instruments and making it available to the technologists than an LIS vendor is motivated to do. And often there's a lot of information there to make decisions that will never be reported to a physician. So having that highly specialized middleware software to help with the use of their instrumentation makes sense. And because they're all investing in that, and the LIS vendors are focusing a lot on interfacing to EMRs and some of the other issues, I think that that's an accepted direction that we'll see go, so that you'll have extensions on your LIS that add life to the existing system in place.
With that, I'd like to go. Did you want to say something?
That's okay.
I'm going to adjourn the panel. It's 12 o'clock. We're going to have lunch. We'll come back here at 1:30. I want to extend my thanks and gratitude to all the panel members for a very stimulating discussion.